So the first speaker of this afternoon is Johan Spelaes, and the title of his talk is The Shortest, Mitosis and Morphogenesis. Thank you, Johan.
So, good afternoon, everyone. So first, I would like to thank Thomas for the very kind invitation to present our work, which deals with cell division and tissue morphogenesis. And so to illustrate the two questions we would like to ask during my talk, I would like to show you this beautiful movie of the early development of a zebrafish embryo, where both DNA and membrane has been labeled. And what you can appreciate during the development of this tissue is that the process of proliferation and the process of morphogenesis by which you shape organ are coordinated. And this simple observation raises two basic questions in the field. How is cell division regulated during tissue morphogenesis? And how do cell division itself contribute to the overall shaping of an animal? So that at the end of the day, the animal does not only have the correct shape, but he has the correct size and the correct number of cells. And in fact, to address those two questions, we need to work at two very different scales. First, at the cell scale, we need to understand the process of cell division. And the process of cell division has been intensively studied from the temporal point of view. When do cells grow? When do cells divide? In the context of tissue morphogenesis, we also need to understand cell division in space. For example, what you can see here is that the mitotic spindle, which is in green, orients the cell division and positions your two daughter cells. The second thing which is important is that you have to build between those two daughter cells this interface. And therefore, what you can appreciate is that the regulation of cell division in space will define the relative arrangement of the cell within the tissues. And it's quite intuitive to understand that the arrangement of cell within the tissue is going to be key in order to regulate the shaping of an animal. I say intuitive because, in fact, a cell division is an extremely tiny process relative to the overall scale of the animal. So not only do we need to understand this process at the cell level, but we need to understand how collectively cell division can drive large-scale changes at the scale of the embryo. And last but not least, of course, if cells are moving in these tissues, that there are mechanical forces that are applied to the cell, and that cell responds to those mechanical forces, and therefore we need to understand the interplay between cell division and mechanical forces. So in the lab, we use Drosophila melanogaster to study those questions, and we are going to work at a very specific stage, which is a stage of metamorphosis, where the animal is going to transform from the larvae to the adult. And to address this question, some years ago, we started to develop this method, where we can actually image a full tissue during its metamorphosis. And this is what is shown here, and here what Floris has done, actually, is to label, actually, the cell outline with E-calorine, where we label the adjoint junction. And what you can appreciate on this movie is that you can see the general movement of the tissue. For example, you see that the tissue shortens in this direction and flows in this direction. But what is very important from this method is that this method is also multiscale. So therefore, in the same movie, we can appreciate all the cell dynamic. And therefore, we are able to relate what happened at the cell level and what happened at the tissue scale level. For example, you can appreciate that each time a cell divides, you have a black hole because due to cell rounding. And therefore, if you would actually count the number of cell divisions, you will end up with a number close to 25,000 cell divisions. So this tissue is extremely proliferative, allowing to study the interplay between tissue morphogenesis and cell division. And over the year, we have been studying those questions of related to cell division, both at the cell level and also at the tissue scale level, trying to link what happened at the cell and tissue scale level or in group of cells. And today, I would like to tell you about two works. One is on the regulation of cytokinesis, in other words, how you build this interface between those two daughter cells. And then I will tell you about some of the general tools we have developed, allowing to actually bridge what happened at the cell level and what happened at the tissue scale level. So cytokinesis is the last step of cell division, and it has been intensively studied from the single cell point of view. Cytokinesis is actually driven by a myosin contractility, where an actomyosin ring assembles at the equator of the cell and therefore deforms the membrane, leading to the contraction and the formation of a tiny point called the midbody. This contractility is driven, of course, by myosin, by ROCK, and also by septin and anilin, which are important in order to attach this ring to the membrane. And if you look actually at what happened when you look at two dividing cells in a petri dish where they are in the isolation, it's exactly the situation you have at the end of the process. You see actually this tiny interface formed between your two daughter cells. And having actually 25,000 cell division, we thought that it would be very important actually to study how you generate this interface between your two daughter cells. So this question has attracted actually the study of by many labs, and there is several reasons for this. Obviously, each time you divide, you will reform a new adherent junction at the interface between your two daughter cells. So if you think about a tissue which is growing, in fact, most of the interfaces and most of the adherent junction that you build at between your two daughter cells are the ones that will be actually present in your tissues. In other words, if you would like to understand how polarity is actually maintained through proliferation, you need to understand how you build new adherent junction at the time of cytokinesis. Furthermore, it has been shown that this is also very important for the regulation of planar cell polarity or for the transmission of signal between two daughter cells. But what strikes us mostly when we looked at those movies is that instead of forming a tiny interface in this process, what we observed actually was that we actually form a very long interface between the two daughter cells. And therefore, our key question was actually how what can distinguish the process of cytokinesis when cells are alone and cells which are within the tissues. And obviously, the main difference between those two situations is quite simple. This cell is alone, and this cell has neighbors. So one of the first questions that Sophie did in the lab when we started on this project was very simple. She decided to take a cell which is about to divide, and she decided to analyze the contribution of the neighboring cell. And to do so, what she did was just to ablate the surrounding cell using a laser. And when she did this, what she observed was quite striking. She observed that in this context, when you have ablated the surrounding cell, instead of forming a long interface between your two daughter cells, you now form a tiny interface, indicating that the process of formation of a long interface does not appear to be a property of the dividing cell, but more a property of its neighbors. Of course, this is a brute force experiment, but this pushes us to look a little bit more at what happened at the process of cell division in the neighbors. And to do so, what Sophie did was quite simple. She labeled actually the membrane of the dividing cell using PhDFP, and she also labeled myosin. And of course, what we are expecting to see is that myosin will be in the cytokinetic ring that we see here from the top, and it's exactly what you see. And what you can see is that at the beginning of the process, those two membranes are far apart. But very rapidly, they will become juxtaposed. And this juxtaposition is concomitant to the accumulation of the red signal, therefore myosin, in the neighboring cell. I'm going to show you this again. You see the cytokinetic form, but very rapidly, at the time of junction juxtaposition, myosin appears in the neighbors. So this seems to suggest that myosin in the neighbor might be important to regulate this process. And we have done several experiments to test this, and I'm going to show you only one, which is the following. Of course, if you remove myosin throughout the tissue, you don't get any cytokinesis. So the experiment that Sophie did was quite simple. She decided to take a dividing cell, which is fully wild-type and has also a wild-type neighbor, and she juxtaposed those cells with cells which are mutant for myosin. And what you can see is that on the wild-type cell, basically those two junctions juxtapose while they stay far apart in the cell which is mutant for myosin, indicating that myosin is important in the neighbor to regulate your juxtaposition and therefore the geometry of this interface. So this was published some time ago, and this revealed a very simple interplay between the dividing cell and its neighbors. At the time of cytokinesis, the contraction of the cytokinetic ring is associated with the accumulation of myosin in the neighbor, leading to the juxtaposition. What was quite important for us is that there was this beautiful paper from the Jérôme Gros lab that was published more recently, where he showed actually that in chick embryo, so invertebrate, contractility in the neighbors is also important to regulate the geometry of the interface. And furthermore, he went a little bit further than we did and showed that the nature of this interface is quite important in order to regulate the overall dynamic of our tissues. And therefore, a key question that emerged from those studies was how a dividing cell can actually signal to his neighbors in order to regulate the formation of this interface and therefore the overall dynamic of the tissues. So Diana, who started this project, decided to do a very set of very simple experiments to test whether, in fact, this signal is not due to mechanics. So the first experiment that Diana did was simple. She actually ablated the cytokinetic ring. And when she does this, what she sees is that the membrane recoils, telling you that, in fact, there is tension exerted by the cytokinetic ring because the velocity at which this recoil takes place is a proxy for the magnitude of the force which is exerted by the cytokinetic ring. What you can also appreciate on this movie is that when you ablate, you reduce, actually, the accumulation of myosin in the neighbors. suggesting that maybe contractile force exerted by cytokinetic ring are important to accumulate myosin in the neighbors. So to test this more directly, what Diana did was to try to look at mutants that might affect the magnitude of the force which is exerted by the cytokine, by the dividing cell. So this is a wild-type case, and if you ablate, you can measure a certain recoil velocity, which scales with the magnitude of the force which is exerted by the cytokinetic ring. And what she did was to take, for example, this mutant, which is septin in fly, and what she found in this case is that you have a striking reduction of the magnitude of the force which is exerted by the cytokinetic ring. Of course, the next experiment was to look what happened in the neighbor in this context, and when she generated dividing cells which are mutant for peanuts, so therefore they exert less forces, what she could observe is that the amount of myosin which is accumulating in the neighbors is strikingly reduced. Of course, this might reflect a specific function of septin in the dividing cell. So to challenge this hypothesis, he decided to look at other mutants that might reduce the force that is exerted by the dividing cell. And for example, she looked, of course, at peanuts, as I just showed you, but she looked at ROCK and she looked at aniline. And they have those genes have different functions during the process of cytokinesis. But what's quite striking is that if you measure the force which is exerted in those different mutants, you have a nice scaling relationship with the amount of myosin which is accumulating in the neighbors. So those data suggested that, in fact, there is a relationship between the amount of force which is exerted by the dividing cell and the amount of myosin which accumulates in the neighbors. So this prompted us to look more closely at whether this signal was not indeed a mechanosensing signal. And I think you had a beautiful introduction by Alfayab on the process of mechanotransduction of adherent junction, and I will try to summarize, I think, years of work in one slide. And the basic idea behind mechanotransduction is that when cadherins are engaged through alpha-catenin to the underlying cytoskeleton, if you exert a force on the cadherin, this will lead to the process of mechanotransduction, which will reinforce adhesion. And most prominently, this often depends on the recruitment of vinculin. And you see that what is very important for this transduction to occur is that alpha-catenin is engaged actually with the underlying cytoskeleton so that the force can be sensed actually. So, of course, those seminal work from many labs give us a large number of candidates that we could test in the neighbor to check whether they are important for the signaling between the dividing cell and its neighbors. And as I say, vinculin is one of the most prominent ones, but when Diana looked at a vinculin mutant, what she observed is that, in fact, she did not reduce the amount of vinculin in the neighboring cell. And I have to say that she spent more than a year testing all the known molecules which has been so far involved in mechanotransduction, and at best, she reduced actually the rate at which you accumulate myosin, but she did never decrease actually completely the level of myosin, suggesting that, in fact, we are not looking at a classical mechanotransduction process, but at something which appears to be different. And so to try to begin to address this question, what are the type of signal which is sensed between the dividing cell and its neighbors, she went back to the movies of the process of cytokinesis, and she looked at them in more detail and with higher temporal resolution and spatial resolution. And I'm going to show you one of these movies. So here you have E-cadherin, which is labeled in green, and you have myosin, which is labeled in red. And obviously, at the light microscopy resolution, those two signals are actually colocalized. When the cytokinesis ring assembled, what she noticed quite strikingly was that, in fact, what you can see is that the cortex now is localized far away from the site of ingression. And since we could localize many molecules of the cortex in this region, what we concluded is that the process of cytokinesis was associated with the detachment of the cortex from the neighboring cell. And you can see that this detachment is concomitant with a decrease of E-cadherin. I'm sorry, the projector is not contrasted enough, but you will have some cadherin along this ingressing membrane, but there is a sharp decrease of E-cadherin in the ingressing membrane. So therefore, there is two processes that precede myosin accumulation in the neighbors: the cortex detachment and the decrease of E-cadherin. And as I say, both precede the accumulation of myosin in the neighbors. So in order to analyze what drives the accumulation of myosin, we saw that the simplest model was that when you have a cortex which is detached, now this cortex is not engaged with the alpha-catenin, and therefore it might be just free to contract, actually. Okay? So therefore, the detachment of the cortex might be the signaling event that will lead to the accumulation of myosin. However, all the experiments that we did to prove this model just disprove it, and I'm going to show you two. So one of the experiments that Diana did was just to ablate the cortex once it has detached, And when she does this, she finds that the accumulation comes back. So therefore, the detached cortex is not necessary to lead to myosin accumulation. The second experiment that she did was to go back to those mutants, such as the septin mutant, that exerts very little forces. And if cortex detachment is essential for myosin accumulation, we should not see cortex detachment in this context. And actually, we see the opposite. I'm going to focus here. So here you have a cell which is mutant for peanuts, so it exerts low level of forces, but you see that you detach the cortex. However, you never establish a steady accumulation of myosin in the neighbors. But you might have noticed something which is quite striking in those movies, that while you detach the cortex, you actually do not decrease the level of Icarin. Therefore, this gives us the idea that the signal might not be the detachment of the cortex, but actually the local decrease of Icarin. And to test this hypothesis, Diana did the following experiments. So the idea was that we are going to take a cell, which is mutant for peanuts, so this cell exerts low level of forces, and we are going to juxtapose those cells with cells which are mutant for an hypomorphic allele of calorine, so that actually you start with a reduced level of E-calorine at the interface between those two daughter cells. And what we would like to observe in this case is whether by reducing the level of E-calorine, we are going to rescue the accumulation of myosin in the neighbors. And what is quite important in this experiment is that here you have your control situation where you have the normal level of E-calorine. And what Diana observed in this context is that on this side, of course, you don't accumulate myosin, but here you start to see an accumulation of myosin. And of course, this is not as striking as the one that we observe in the wild type, but we get a significant rescue of the accumulation of myosin. These experiments have at least two conclusions. First, they tell you that this is not the magnitude of the force, which is sense, because the magnitude of the force is similar on the two sides. And the second one is that the signal is most likely the decrease of E-calorin that is sensed by the neighbors. And therefore, what is sensed is probably this decrease due to junction elongation. So, of course, the next question was, how do you actually decrease locally your level of E-calorin? So, and there is only two mechanisms by which you can decrease the level of E-calorin. There are the following one. You can actually remove E-calorin molecules, okay? Therefore, you will have a decrease of the signal if you tag your molecule with GFP. Or you can actually dilute E-calorin. So for example, as when the membrane ingresses, you elongate your junction. And therefore, this, by just this elongation of the junction, might lead to an impression of the dilution, the local dilution of E-calorin. So to test those two models, we did something which is very simple, which is just to compute the total amount of E-calorin within the junction. And what Diana observed in this context is that, in fact, if anything, the total amount of E-calorin increase, which is completely, which rules out the fact that actually the decrease of E-calorin is due to a removal of E-calorin molecule. She backed up this by showing that, for example, E-calorin endocytosis or recycling or delivery was not affecting actually the decrease of E-calorin at this interface. And therefore, we were left with one hypothesis, which is actually the dilution hypothesis. And I'm going to show you some data that also support this idea. So if you look at the junction that is elongated at the interface between the two daughter cells, you can see that the junction elongates, and at the same time, you actually decrease the level of E-calorin. But now if we take a mutant for septin, which exerts low level of forces, you can see that actually you don't dilute your E-calorin. You don't elongate significantly, actually, your membrane, and actually, you don't dilute your E-calorin. So based on this argument, what we concluded was that, in fact, the decrease of E-calorin was purely due to the dilution of the E-calorin associated with the elongation of the membrane. So the last thing that we had to resolve was how a dilution of E-calorin can lead to a local accumulation of myosin at the site of ingression. So, and for this, we thought about a very simple model. It's a biological model, and I will show you the physical version of it. So the idea is quite simple. The idea is that if you dilute your E-calorin, basically, again, the basic idea is that the engagement of alpha-catenin to the underlying cytoskeleton, what we thought creates some friction. Basically, you have some friction between those molecules. When you decrease E-calorin, now your cortex might be free, actually, more free to contract. And so the idea that we wanted to analyze was whether, by modeling the dilution of E-calorin by a local decrease of friction, whether this will be sufficient to trigger an accumulation of myosin. So the way we did this was by modeling just this region of the cell. And the idea is that inside the ingression, we are going to assume that there is low friction. Well, here we are going to assume that there is high friction. And the first thing to test was whether this simple model that only models this part is sufficient to lead to a myosin accumulation. And this is indeed what we observe, that in this model, we can get a steady state accumulation of myosin just at this region. Furthermore, the model made two predictions. The prediction that he made was that, in fact, this accumulation of myosin should depend on lactomyosin flows, whose velocity should depend on contractility. So therefore, this model gives us what was shown that it was sufficient to have this decrease of friction associated with reduction of E-calorin, but it made two predictions that we could test, whether the accumulation was due to actomyosin flows and whether this will depend on the contractility of the neighbors. So to address this question, the first thing that Diana did was actually to localize, to look at F-actin using the LIFE-FACT probe, and here she only labeled the neighbors so that you can see the flows in the neighbor zone. And so quite nicely, she could observe that, in fact, the ingression was nicely associated with the retrograde flow of actin in the neighboring cell. And furthermore, if you actually reduce contractility in the neighbors, she actually loses these flows. And you can see that there is a striking decrease in the velocity of the flows, which is actually consistent and associated with a decrease of the accumulation of myosin. Therefore, based on this, we concluded that during cell division, at each cell division, there is a mechanosensing event that takes place between the dividing cell and its neighbors. And this mechanosensing event allows for the coupling of the cell division and the remodeling of this junction. And I think this is quite in light of Al-Fayyad showing you this morning, where you can see that the dynamic of cell during cell division or during apoptosis is also associated with communication between the cell and its neighbors. So to conclude, to move on, I would like now to show you what we have done at the cell, at the scale of the tissues. And obviously, when we look at those movies, our striking will was actually to describe what we see under the microscope. Because, of course, very often, when you do biology, what you want to do is, first thing, is to describe what you see. Of course, you can take these movies and put them in the computers and actually segment those movies. So this was done through the gigantic effort of Boris Guirao and Stefan Rigaud in the lab. And you can see that actually you can actually follow all the cells and how they are dividing. Here, the cells which are in green divide once, this one divide twice, and this time divide three times. You can actually also follow the flows of cell within these tissues and actually look at those displacements of cell. And if you look at those movies and put them in a computer, what you end up with with numbers. So you get 25,000 cell division, we had to track 10 million cell contour, we had 200,000 cell arrangement, and roughly 5,000 cell delamination. However, those numbers are quite relevant, but we are missing a piece of information which is illustrated by this very simple equation. So if you would like to understand the process of morphogenesis, what you have to do is to link what happened at the cell level and what happened at the tissue level. So therefore, what you would like to do is to relate the contribution of cell division, cell shape changes, cell rearrangement, and delamination to the overall growth of a tissue. However, when we look at those processes, here I'm going to show you a cell shape changes, here a cell rearrangement, here a cell division, and here a delamination, you can see that those processes are almost nothing in common. They are very different. So it's very hard to put them in the same equation. And to try to bring them in the same unit, Boris Guirao, in close collaboration with our long-standing collaborator, François Graner, developed a full formalism, and the idea of the formalism is quite simple. Is instead of thinking about the cell, you have to think about the link between one cell and its neighbors. And if you do so, and I spare you the mathematics and the physics behind it, you can actually replace actually all those processes by a very simple unit, which is a circle, which tells you how much the process has led to a change in size, or a contraction, or a dilation, or a contraction here, and a bar which tells you about the anisotropy of the process in terms of elongation. And therefore, what you can do is to replace those movies by a very simple quantification. Here, I'm showing you only the bar, where you can look at the convergence extension, which is how local pieces of tissue has elongated. But what is important is that you can now decompose this convergence extension into the contribution of cell division, the one of cell shape changes, the one of cell rearrangement, and the one of apoptosis. And therefore, you can replace this very intuitive equation by a more rigorous one, where you are going to relate actually what happened at the cell level with what happened at the tissue scale level. Obviously, this is not the only type of formalism that has been developed, and there is a very nice formalism that has been developed by Suzanne Eaton and Frank Julicher. There is one also from Bénédicte Sanson and Guy Blanchard labs. What is important to point out here in this formalism is that in this case, we really directly relate what happened for every type of morphogenetic process that happened at the cell level with what happened at the tissue scale level. And this formalism is also already valid in 3Ds. And for example, we have recently applied it in the context of tissue repair in collaboration with Valentina Greco to understand the process of cell migration. So to conclude, we'd like to say that, in fact, the process of cell division has been extensively studied at the single cell level. And what we would like to propose is that, in fact, if you would like to understand the process of cell division, what you need to think about is not only the cell, but its first neighbors. And if you do so, actually, you will understand the process of cytokinesis. I have shown you that by thinking about link, actually, you can describe the morphogenesis of the tissues. And we mostly recently published by, in fact, in the tricellular junction of the tissues, which are defined by the position of the dividing cell and its neighbors, are quite important to orient cell division. And with this, I would like to end and thank the people who did the work. So the work on cytokinesis was initiated by Sophie Herzeg, and it was followed by a very talented also PhD student, Diana Pinheiro, who is now in Carl Philipp Eisenberg lab. The work on tissue morphogenesis was beautifully started by Floris Boswell, who is here in Chile. And the work on the framework has been done by Boris Guirao in the collaboration with Stéphane Rigaud for the segmentation. And those work are in close collaboration with two physicists, Edouard Ananzo for the part on cytokinesis, and with François Goaner, a long-standing, with whom we have a long and very fruitful collaboration. I would like to thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.